Hello everyone, I hope you're all well. Welcome to episode 3 of Blood Runs Cold, a true crime podcast looking at cases from around the world involving murder, missing persons, miscarriages of justice and more. I'm Peter, creator and host of this podcast, and in this episode we're going to go back to 1986 and look at the as yet unsolved murder of Linda Cook, also known as the Cinderella murder, and which led to a miscarriage of justice that saw the wrong man spend 16 years in prison. Before we get started, I just want to thank all those who are listening now and who have listened to the first couple of episodes of this podcast. It really does mean a lot. It's a new podcast, and in order for it to grow, I kind of need people to listen, show some support, give us some 5-star reviews, subscribe to the YouTube channel, follow us on social media, tell your friends about us. You never know, in a couple of years when this podcast is absolutely massive, you can look back and say to your friends, remember, I told you about that one. Seriously though, every bit of support is very, very much appreciated, and I say thank you again. Also, as always, there may be topics or opinions in this episode that some people may find triggering or upsetting. It isn't my aim to cause upset or anything, so I'd recommend you read the show notes and the description and proceed with caution if you are likely to find any of these topics triggering in any way. But that's enough of that. Let's get on with the episode. So, on Tuesday, 9th of December 1986, the naked body of a woman was discovered on wasteland in an area known as Merry Row in Buckland, which is an area of Portsmouth on the south coast of England. Police were called and the body was soon identified as that of 24-year-old local barmaid Linda Cook. She had been raped, strangled and stamped on with such force that her jaw and spine were both fractured, her larynx was crushed and an imprint of an athletic shoe with the word flash was left in the young woman's abdomen. The first thing for police to do was to find out more about Linda Cook, to try and build a picture of her movements up until the moment she was killed, and also try to identify anyone who would want to cause her harm. Unfortunately, there isn't much information available about Linda Cook, the type of person she was, her hobbies, interests, hopes and dreams, etc. So it was difficult for me to build a picture of her, to kind of humanise her rather than just seeing her as a victim. In all the cases that I cover, and I will cover in the future, I want to try and put the emphasis on the victims of the crimes that I'm covering, and it's a bit sad when I can't do that due to a lack of information, but this is a case I wanted to cover, so we proceed. All that I could find out was that the police soon discovered Linda Cook lived at the home of a woman called Linda Gray, who was the mother of Linda Cook's boyfriend, although he wasn't there at the time as he had recently been remanded to a detention centre. Gray apparently accounted for Linda Cook's whereabouts for the majority of the day, and she told police that Linda had left the house at around 11:30 p.m. to go to her friend's, which was a short walk away. Police then ascertained that she was at her friend's for only a short time, and she left there not long after midnight. The belief among officers was that she had been attacked on her way home between 12:30 and 1 a.m, with the attack probably lasting up to around 15 minutes. There had been several serious sex attacks in the Buckland area in the weeks before Linda Cook's murder, with the attacker dubbed the Beast of Buckland by the media, so there was an automatic link. Police may have believed the sex attacker had stepped up his attacks and had gotten more ferocious, becoming a murderer now and not just a rapist. Women that lived in the local and surrounding areas were living in fear, and police were under a lot of pressure from the start to ensure they caught the killer before he had the chance to strike again. There were two main pieces of evidence for the police to get their investigation kick-started and hopefully lead them closer to a murderer. There was a semen sample taken from Linda's body, which was clear it had to have come from the murderer due to no traces being found in her underwear, which had been discarded and found a short distance away from her body. Also, if Linda had had a sexual encounter with anyone else during the day, there would have been traces of semen found in the underwear. So, as there weren't, the only possibility was that the semen found inside her was from her killer. DNA wasn't exactly advanced back in those days, so full profiling wasn't available, but the police did manage to find out the killer was blood type O positive, and this at least would enable them to narrow down their suspect pool. The second bit of vital evidence was the imprint of the athletic shoe, which allowed police to find out an approximate shoe size for the killer, and they knew the footwear had a distinctive tread because of the word flash that was in the heel area. It was the footwear evidence that led to the media dubbing Linda Cook's murder the Cinderella murder, with the police searching for someone who owned unique footwear, just as Prince Charming had in the classic fairy tale, although the reasons for the searches couldn't have been more different. Once the investigation began, police carried out door-to-door inquiries. They questioned local people looking for witnesses and tried to find any new leads. One of the women they spoke to during these inquiries was a local woman by the name of Dina Fogg, and she would lead police directly to a man they came to believe was responsible for Linda's brutal murder. Fogg had told police that during a night out at Joanna's nightclub in Portsmouth on the night Linda Cook was murdered, she had met an 18-year-old sailor by the name of Michael Shirley, whose ship was stationed nearby. They spent a little while together in the club, and as the night drew to an end, Fogg agreed to go home with the young sailor. The pair left the club and jumped in a taxi together. But Fogg said she changed her mind during the drive, so she asked the driver to stop at a random block of flats. She gave an excuse that she had to go and pick her child up from her mother's house, and she used this excuse as a way of exiting the taxi without Michael Shirley. She then entered the block of flats using one entrance, left via another that was out of sight from everyone, and returned home on her own. Shirley apparently then waited in a taxi for around 15 minutes before realising he'd been tricked and that the woman he thought he was going to get lucky with had actually done a runner. He may have thought he was going to get his leg over, but instead he was left sat in a taxi looking like a bit of a fool. So he paid the driver, spent a short while walking around trying to find Fogg to probably ask her why she bolted, and then he got another taxi back to the HMS Apollo on which he was stationed. 2 days later, Shirley and Fogg bumped into each other again and chatted briefly. He then left Portsmouth and headed to Leamington Spa in Warwickshire to spend Christmas with his parents while he was on shore leave. He then returned to Portsmouth in the new year and decided he would try his luck at Joanna's one last time before his ship departed for the Falkland Islands. During that night, on the 5th of January 1987, he again encountered Dina Fogg, but this time the woman pointed him out to police and he was arrested and taken into custody for questioning. Detectives built a case against Shirley, and later in January they charged a teenage able seaman with the murder of Linda Cook, and he was remanded to Winchester Prison to await trial. The police believed that Shirley had become angry due to Fogg leaving him stranded in a taxi looking like an idiot, so he took out his frustrations on the first woman he saw, who happened to be Linda Cook. They say he then raped her and murdered her in a fit of rage, with the rage proven by the extent of the injuries the victim had sustained. A year later, on the 18th of January 1988, the trial of Michael Shirley began at Winchester Crown Court before Judge Mr. Justice Hutchison, with the prosecution's entire case resting purely on circumstantial evidence. Due to a lack of forensic evidence and the pretty flimsy circumstantial case against him, Shirley's legal team was completely confident of securing a not guilty verdict for their client. Seriously, when you see the case that was built up against Michael Shirley, I'm totally amazed it even made it to court in the first place. There are many, many cases I've seen in documentaries and that I've read about and stuff that were a lot stronger, but that the CPS threw out due to insufficient evidence. So, in my opinion, Shirley was extremely unlucky to have even gone on trial in the first place. The case the police had built was built on a few pieces of evidence. Firstly, there was the fact that the young man had the same blood type as the killer, which had been identified through the semen samples taken from Linda's body. He also admitted to owning a pair of the unique athletic shoes with the word Flash imprinted on the heel, but that he said were at home at his parents more than 100 miles away. He had scratches on his cheek, his eyebrow and his shoulder at the time of his arrest. There was apparently a missing half an hour in his story, and he had told police he was with a woman named Sue on the night of the murder. They had also claimed that he had only returned to Joanna's nightclub in the new year to find Dina Fogg and convince her to be his alibi. Now, to some people, it might sound like a bit of a compelling case, but as mentioned, it was all circumstantial and there was probably more evidence to disprove the prosecution's case than what there was to prove Shirley's guilt. Firstly, a quarter of all adult males in the United Kingdom share the same blood type as Shirley and the killer. There was also no blood or matching fibres found on Shirley or Linda Cook to connect the two together. The athletic shoe, which the prosecution made such a big deal out of and made out like it was totally unique, was actually an extremely popular item of footwear at the time. Around 185,000 pairs had been imported into the United Kingdom in the space of 3 years before 1986, with around 9,000 pairs sold in the UK in 1986 alone. 250 of those pairs were sold in the Portsmouth area. Also, when a forensic team examined Shirley's pair, they found no blood or any other evidence linking them to the murder. The scratches on Shirley's face and body had pretty much healed by the time of his arrest, and prosecutors stated they were approximately 4 weeks old, which would mean they could have been caused when Linda was fighting for her life. The defence team stated that it was impossible for them to correctly date the injuries with that amount of accuracy. There was also the fact that Linda Cook's fingernails were unbroken, and there was no trace evidence to suggest she had scratched her attacker. If the scratches were caused by Linda Cook fighting back during Shirley attacking her, there would have been some kind of evidence to back that up. But unbelievably, the jury was never told any of this information. They were never told how popular the athletic shoe was. They were never told that there was no trace evidence under Linda Cook's fingernails and that her nails were indeed unbroken. They were never told about the amount of people that had the same matching blood type. They were never told that Shirley's pair of trainers didn't have any evidence on them. Basically, they weren't told anything. I'm not quite sure why, to be honest. Surely the defence team would have used this information as a way of disproving the prosecution claims, but obviously not. By the sounds of it, all the jury was told was one side of the story, and that was the police's case, the prosecution side of the case. So I can't get my head around why, to be fair. But as for the missing half an hour in Shirley's story, Fogg had said in her original statement to police that she and Shirley left the club at around 12:30 together. This would place Shirley well away from the scene of Linda Cook's murder at the time it happened. Also, the taxi driver's logbook showed that he picked the pair up from the taxi rank at 12:25. And again, you guessed it, the jury wasn't told this information. Instead, they were told what Fogg said in her second statement, which gave the time of departure for Fogg and Shirley from the club at 30 minutes earlier. It would later emerge this statement was made under duress and that Dina Fogg had been kept at the police station for around 10 hours before changing her story. As for Shirley telling police he was with a woman named Sue, you probably guessed this bit as well, but that was the name that Dina Fogg told him she was called. Michael Shirley had told the police everything, all about his night. He didn't lie, he didn't hold anything back from them. But it seems that they decided he was the man to pin Linda Cook's murder on, and they would do whatever they could, including twisting stories, getting people to change their statements, and finding evidence that wasn't really there to make him look guilty. It angers me. It angers me so much when I see cases like this. There are so many examples of cases like this where a so-called suspect is so clearly innocent of the crime, but still police do whatever they can to make them guilty, to make them look guilty to a court. The police are supposed to be there to find criminals, to find the sick bastards who commit rape and murder, to follow the correct chain of evidence and find the right person. And they're also there to support, they're supposed to anyway, protect the innocent. But in this case, it seems that the police just needed a result. They needed to secure a conviction to ease the mounting pressure on them, to make the women in the local area feel safer. So they didn't care if Shirley was guilty or not. All that seemed to matter to them was that he was found guilty in court. They seemingly didn't really stop to think that somewhere out there was a real killer. A sick, twisted sexual predator who was free and who would most probably strike again. Who was free to rape and murder and do whatever he wanted to do. And how many women fell victim because the police pinned this crime on the wrong man? Did those officers live with remorse? Did they lie awake at night pondering the answer to that question I just posed? But anyway, after a 10-day trial, a completely misinformed jury deliberated for just 6 hours and 34 minutes before delivering a guilty verdict with a majority of 11-1. Michael Shirley had been found guilty in court and was convicted of the rape and murder of Linda Cook on the 28th of September 1988, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. An application to appeal the conviction was later rejected, and the judge, Sir David Croom Johnson, said, quote, "There were no lingering doubts over Shirley's guilt," end quote. No lingering doubt. So you're having a fucking laugh. That to me is a load of bollocks. A young man had lost his career and his freedom because of circumstantial evidence and a trial where the majority of vital information had been held back from the jury. And old Sir David reckoned there were no lingering doubts. I am not quite sure how these people sleep at night if they do. Shirley maintained his innocence and embarked on a 5-week hunger strike and a rooftop protest during 1992. It was during this time that journalist Neil Humber was granted permission to see Shirley in prison. Neil Humber was one of the first people to notice the discrepancies in Fogg's two statements, and he made a lot of sacrifices in order to fight Shirley's corner for him. He was even dismissed from his job with a newspaper in order for him to write a 49-page report for the Home Office, which gave evidence of Shirley's innocence in the hope that they would review the case. This came after another hunger strike from Shirley in January 1993 that lasted for 42 days and almost cost him his life. At last, someone was determined to get to the truth, and Humber passed his findings to the authorities. But Hampshire police were asked to investigate, and it was hardly likely that the same police force that concocted a case against Shirley was now going to turn around and admit that they were wrong. Again, it seemed like nobody who had the power to clear Shirley wanted to do anything about it. It was setback after setback after setback. And even the Home Secretary in 1995, Michael Howard, denied Shirley the right to an appeal yet again. Neil Humber wasn't going to give up, though. He fully believed that Michael Shirley was innocent, and he kept putting pressure on the authorities to retest DNA samples. However, he was told that they'd all been destroyed. that all the DNA samples that were taken at the time had been destroyed. They'd gone, no one could find them. But that actually proved to be untrue, and eventually the police did find the samples, apparently put away just in a drawer at a storage unit. Like you'd throw something in a drawer in your kitchen as you got home, you know, like didn't really matter. These samples were tested again, and this time, due mostly to the advances in forensic science, DNA showed without a shadow of a doubt that Michael Shirley was an innocent man. The young man who had taken an oath of allegiance to serve his queen and country in the Royal Navy had been sent to prison for a crime he didn't commit as an 18-year-old boy, and he wasn't granted his freedom until he was 34 years old. The whole world had changed while Shirley was in prison, and he had missed it all. He had missed out on his entire adult life up to that point. Speaking in 2002, MP James Plaskett said of Shirley's case, quote, "The system failed in the original trial and it has been decidedly sluggish in helping him clear his name," end quote. Shirley himself thanked Neil Humber and said it was only the journalists fighting his corner for him that made people believe what he had said for all those years. He was finally released from prison in 2003, but he could have been released earlier if he had admitted his guilt. He was refused parole a year earlier on the grounds that he was in denial over his guilt, and he couldn't be released until he faced up to what he had done. It wasn't denial, though. He didn't need to face up to what he had done. He really was an innocent man, and he was willing to spend the rest of his life in prison rather than confess to something he hadn't done. A lesser man may have broken. They may have said whatever it took to be released, but Shirley stood his ground, and that shows an enormous sense of character. His lawyer, Anita Bromley, said after his release, quote, "Michael's case shows how easy it is to be convicted of murder and how very hard it is to overturn that conviction," end quote. Shirley did an exclusive interview with the Evening Telegraph when he got out of prison, and he spoke of how compensation could never give him back what he had lost. He said, "At 18, I thought I knew everything, but I now realise how naive I was." He also spoke about how he wondered how his life would have turned out. Whether he would have been married, had kids, still been in the Navy, or if he would have transferred to the Royal Marines like he was considering doing so before his arrest. Another thing he spoke about in the interview was how difficult it was trying to get released from prison, and how he felt like he was crying into the dark with nobody there to hear him. He also mentioned the fact the real killer had never been caught, saying, quote, "Somewhere there is someone who has got away with murder, and for all we know, may have murdered again," end quote. That's probably the biggest thing to take from all of this. Linda Cook was brutally raped and murdered, and the wrong man was sent to prison. And in all those years since, there's someone out there who knows he was really the one who did it. Did that give him more confidence? Did he go on to kill again? Had he killed before? Until we know who he is, we will never know just how many victims he has, I guess. So, Shirley was out of prison, left to wonder what his life would have been like and trying to adjust to a world very different to the one that he last saw as a free man. And the question still remained. Who had killed Linda Cook? Police reopened the murder case after Shirley's release, but many cases involving miscarriages of justice fail to progress after the wrongly convicted person has had their conviction overturned. Hopefully, this case will eventually prove to be different, but as I'm recording this, it still hasn't been solved yet. One person who believed he knew who killed Linda is retired police officer Chris Clark. He may have retired from the police force in the early 90s, but he uses his intelligence gathering skills and experience to look at unsolved cases to make sure that they're not forgotten. His website, armchairdetective.org.uk, has articles, radio interviews and stuff, with Clark looking at several cases, both solved and unsolved. I'm not sure how old some of these pieces are. I don't think any of them are dated, really, but they make for interesting reading nonetheless. And some people may dismiss Clark as just making things up to try and stay relevant or get himself back in the public eye or whatever, but you never know. There could be some truth to what he says. And Clark believes that Linda Cook's murderer is convicted killer and rapist Paul Barry Taylor. And here's why he came to that conclusion. Taylor killed 22-year-old Sally Ann McGrath in 1979 after meeting her in a bar, attacking her and stamping on her before dumping her body in woodland. He also committed several sex attacks in the same area before killing McGrath. Taylor wasn't actually brought to justice for those crimes until 2012 when he was found guilty and sentenced to a minimum of 18 years in prison. But McGrath was killed in Peterborough, and Taylor's other crimes were committed in that area as well. So, how does Clark link him to Linda's murder? Well, Taylor went to prison in September 1979, 2 weeks after killing McGrath, for attacking his 16-year-old sister-in-law and attempting to rape her. He was convicted of actual bodily harm and sentenced to 2 years in prison. And upon his release, he moved down south. In 1985, he moved to a place called Fareham, which is just 6 miles from Portsmouth. There are similarities between the murders of Sally Amagrath and Linda Cook, with a pattern of sex assaults leading up to a murder in the area. Could these sex assaults and killings have followed Taylor down the country? Clark has urged police to take a closer look at Taylor. Apparently, a witness came forward and gave a description of a man running from the scene of Linda's murder that matched Taylor's description, and this report has apparently never been followed up. It is the belief of Clark that Hampshire police don't want to reinvestigate and have somewhat closed the book on the case, with him saying that if they do look for someone else, they will have to admit overlooking a very good potential suspect in their wild goose chase to get a result. I'm not sure how true that sentiment is, though, and Hampshire police have come out and said that they've reviewed all the information and evidence available with regards to Linda Cook, and the murder case is still ongoing. Another point I just want to make about Taylor is that if he wasn't convicted of his crimes until 2012, surely he would have had his DNA taken when arrested. There was a DNA sample that helped get Michael Shirley released from prison, so wouldn't it be just a simple process to say whether or not Taylor did kill Linda Cook? Not sure why it would be so difficult for the police to just say either way if Taylor was involved, but they haven't as yet. Another possible suspect who was named in the media in recent years was David Fuller. In November 2021, Fuller was found guilty and convicted of the 1987 sexual assaults and murders of Wendy Nell and Caroline Pierce in Kent, with the murders dubbed the Bedsit Murders. These killings were finally solved after a review of the National DNA database partially matched Fuller's brother to samples taken in 1987, and then Fuller was found to be a billion to one match. Originally, he pleaded not guilty but changed his plea midway through the trial. He also then admitted the sexual abuse of over 100 corpses in a morgue at the Kent and Sussex Hospital in Tunbridge Wells, Kent, during his time working as an electrician there. Police actually found around 4 million images of sexual abuse at his home in Sussex after he admitted having filmed himself having sex with dead bodies. After his conviction, it was immediately reported that Fuller was being looked at as a possible suspect in Linda Cook's murder, with two main points of interest. Firstly, he had grown up in a house just a mile away from the Lake Road scene of Linda's murder, so he had great knowledge of the area. And then there was also the fact he had left a bloody footprint at the scene of Wendy Nell's murder. A police source at the time apparently said they were linking Fuller to many unsolved cases and that they believe his crimes were so abhorrent that his offending would not be limited to just the ones he had admitted. However, just a few days later, it was made known that Fuller had been fully investigated and eliminated from inquiries regarding Linda Cook's murder. So, there you go. The police had a suspect, they looked into him and then ruled him out. Why can't they do that for Paul Barry Taylor? Unless they have done and just not revealed this information to the public. If he's been named as a possible suspect, surely they've looked at him, looked at the DNA and stuff. But anyway, as it stands, the real killer has never been caught to justice for the murder of Linda Cook. He may have been caught and locked up for another crime. He may or may not have killed before or again. It could have been a random one-off attack and the person never committed another crime. The person could be dead by now. We just don't know. It's unknown. Until you know who that person is, like I said, you'll never know what crimes he committed before and after. I couldn't find anything on Linda Cook's family or anything during my research, but if there are people out there who still care about her, who still miss her, and still pray for the truth, hopefully one day they will get the answers that they seek, and the monster who killed Linda Cook will finally be brought to justice for her murder. In any murder, there are always what-ifs and questions for those who are left behind. The victim's life was cut short far too early and nobody knows how that life would have turned out. But in this case, two people's lives were essentially cut short early. Linda Cook's was taken from her in the most brutal way possible, while Michael Shirley's was taken in a courtroom by those who are supposed to uphold the law and bring guilty people to justice. No one knows how those lives would have turned out, and it's all what-ifs, like I said. Someone somewhere knows who killed Linda Cook, and hopefully one day that person's name will be known to the public. Right, that's the end of another episode of Blood Runs Cold. Episode 3 has come to an end. I just want to say thank you to everyone who's listened to this. It really does mean a lot. I hope you enjoyed it and I hope you will join me all again next time. Yeah, in the meantime, go over, follow us on Instagram, on X, formerly known as Twitter. Go and subscribe to the YouTube channel. All of these podcast episodes will go up on popular podcast platforms, but they will also be available on YouTube as well. I'm hoping that this podcast can build and I can get a kind of a community around it that enjoy what I'm saying and stuff. And hopefully, if you did enjoy it, you will comment on YouTube or you'll like and share and tell your friends and stuff. And join me again next time, like I said. But in the meantime, don't have nightmares. Take care. And bye-bye for now.